This is The Takeaway for Thursday, June 22nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Well, it's been bottled up since last week in a kind of Washington, D.C. secrecy, but this is about as long as they could keep it under wraps. There is now a health care bill before the U.S. Senate. After promising for 7 years to repeal the Affordable Care Act, therefore, Senate Republicans and all Republicans on Capitol Hill are finally putting forth a plan to do just that. It's a 142-page bill right now. It outlines cuts to Medicaid. It would end the mandate set up by Obamacare that was the cornerstone to making the Affordable Care Act work. It would also set up federal tax credits to help Americans buy health insurance and would let states have more flexibility in deciding what services they want to keep and which they want to drop. Joining us now to answer some of the questions and to outline what are still mysteries, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Well, here we go. Present from the Senate.
Here we go, John. The bill that's been long awaited here in a very secretive process. Lots of frustrated senators saying that they didn't like the process that was writing this bill. None of them saying they would use their power to do anything about it. Now have a bill in front of them. Here's Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who left a morning meeting with Republican senators where this discussion draft was released, had a bill in hand, went to the Senate floor.
I'm pleased that we were able to arrive at a draft that incorporates input from so many different members who represent so many different constituents who are facing so many different challenges. The draft containing the solutions I mentioned, along with many others, is posted online, and I encourage everyone to carefully review it.
Now, discussion draft is a new term, right? It means we're going to talk about this, but we're not going to have hearings like we normally would, and we're not going to go through the normal process. And, oh, by the way, it's online.
Well, it might mean that, except we do have legislative text now. There is an actual bill.
Right.
So there were the senators got the discussion draft. Many of them came out of the room and said, I still haven't seen the bill. Meanwhile, over on the floor, the bill came out and McConnell had that bill in hand when he made that statement. Now, that's important because that means the bill now goes to the CBO. We're expecting a score from the
Congressional Budget Office, right?
And that, right, vital. That comes out as early as Monday. And that is what's going to tell us not only the cost, but how many people would lose insurance under this plan. John, at its core, this Senate plan is very similar to the House plan in its contours and shape. What it is from 20 feet back is a huge cut to Medicaid, big tax decreases for wealthier people and medical device companies and other big companies in exchange for cutting insurance for lots of people who get help for it now and for poor people. That's the broad outlines of this plan. And now we have some details of how the Senate plan might be a little bit different from the House plan. It does repeal the individual mandate, which is the thing that Republicans hated the most, probably, about Obamacare. It keeps in place, however, a lot of the tax credits that people have in order to get help buying insurance, but it tightens the restrictions. Fewer people will qualify. Like in the House bill, older people around 58, 59, 62 who are lower income will almost certainly wind up paying a lot more for their health insurance if this bill passes in its current form. Those changes in the tax credits would go into effect in 2020. And then there's the Medicaid piece of this, John, which is pretty gigantic. Now, there was a lot of controversy around the rollback of the Medicaid expansion in the House bill. This bill in the Senate does exactly the same thing, but it does it a little bit slower. It would phase out the expansion in Medicaid that lots of states signed on to give more people health care, but it would phase it out beginning in 2020 and then make deeper cuts after that. Here's Tim Scott, a conservative Republican senator from South Carolina, who I caught up with on his way out of the meeting.
The lowest income will have more access to health insurance at a more affordable price. The folks that we talked about, the hypothetical person making about $12,000 a year, will have more access and at a lower cost for health insurance. And that's a really good thing.
How do they have more access if Medicaid's being cut?
Well, Medicaid's not actually being cut from our perspective.
So, wait a minute. Medicaid's being expanded, the expansion is being eliminated, or Medicaid is actually being cut back from what it is pre-Obamacare?
Medicaid is being cut. Senator Scott there says that Medicaid is not being cut from their perspective. Based on what we see in the bill right now, there's simply no way that that's true. After the 2020 drawback of the Medicaid expansion, what this bill does in the out years is it then establishes a Medicare reimbursement rate for the states that's pegged to inflation. John, right now in the House bill, that rate is pegged to inflation plus medical cost plus 1%. That means that the money available under this bill for Medicaid in the out years, beyond 10 years, is even leaner, is even less, is even a deeper cut than what's in the House bill. That's important because there are Republican senators who've already seen discussions and drafts and rumors in the weeks before this who've said they have been very uncomfortable with some of the Medicaid cuts that they've envisioned. Now, John, you may see some Republican senators coming out either today or in the coming days saying that they're against this bill. And that won't be the end of the story. There's going to be a great deal of, I think, hype and heat around senators who say that they don't like this bill and that in its current form, they might vote against it. But there are going to be lots of opportunities for Mitch McConnell next week when this bill's on the floor to make deals, to make amendments, and to try to give senators things that they want to get their votes. That'll happen throughout the week. There'll be lots of potential votes on the Senate floor. But I want to make, I want to highlight something that nobody's talked about what Mitch McConnell has in his back pocket here to make deals. At the very end of this process, he gets what's colloquially called around here a wraparound amendment. McConnell might try to get wavering senators on board by offering them deals on health care, Medicaid, or other things that they want. And he can throw an amendment on the floor at the very end of this process with very little debate and try to get this passed. He may or may not succeed. He probably doesn't have the votes right now. But even if he doesn't have the votes now, he can make deals to get there.
It's a goodies amendment. One very quick yes or no. Is it illegal to not have insurance under this bill?
It is not illegal. The individual mandate is gone.
Todd Zwillick talking about health care. Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Now let's return to the rollout and possible beginning of the end game for Republican health care reform. It began, you'll recall, with ineffectual Obamacare repeal votes after 2010. And then there was the Trump victory in 2016. And then the real House health care repeal bill that came in early May. And now the 142-page legislative text for a Senate bill that was made public. More now on what the real post-Obamacare world is probably going to look like. We have a glimpse of it. Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News, welcome back to The Takeaway. There are structural changes that we should focus on, and then the sort of ideological goodies that Republicans often like to focus on. Let's separate the differences.
Sure. We have, of course, the Senate bill, like the House bill, and the Senate, we should call the discussion draft, would have massive changes to the Medicaid program. They would slow down, phase down over 3 years, additional funding for the Medicaid expansion, which is a little different in the Senate than the House, but like the House, it would cap Medicaid expenditures from the federal government. That is a significant departure from current practice. Now Medicaid, for example, gives states on a matching basis different percentages around the country per dollar they spend. This Senate draft proposal, like the House passed bill, would put a cap on that. So it would limit Medicaid spending, which is really a very, very big change. Also, the Senate bill, like the House bill, would roll back a lot of the Affordable Care Act taxes, things like taxes on medical device makers and insurers and tanning salons. It wouldn't have any Planned Parenthood funding for a year, even though federal law currently says you can't use any federal funding for abortions. That's what that provision is aimed at. And the Senate bill would slightly differ from the House bill in the tax credits. These are these subsidies that are given to people to help them buy insurance. Instead of having that at 400% of the poverty level, starting in 2020, it would be down to 350% of the poverty level, but it would drop down to people at 0% of poverty. That's not where current law is. And the point being that for some poorer people in states that didn't expand Medicaid, they might be able to get some coverage.
So the mandate is gone, which means you don't have to get insurance.
That's
so that
right.
That means people are sort of out of the umbrella of healthcare. And it also reduces the incentives for people who are out suddenly in the cold to actually be able to get back into the system, right?
Right. I mean, the idea of not having an individual mandate and not having an employer mandate is something Republicans love. But a particularly individual mandate, that gives the policy people a heartburn, because if you don't have everybody in, how do you balance the sick and the healthy? So this idea perhaps of dropping the subsidies down to some of the poorest people, it will depend how they work and how much they have to contribute, but that is theoretically an incentive for them to get in the market without a mandate.
But it's far fewer people than Obamacare has shown that it's brought into the system in the few years that it's been in place.
Well, in the sense of, I mean, are you talking here about the number of people you think who won't have coverage under this bill, or?
Right. I mean, in other words, what's the erosion of coverage? People who are just under these circumstances are going to have to just walk away. And what are the incentives that are no longer in place for people to actually try to get, in the case of Obamacare, subsidies? Now it's something different.
Theoretically, if you bring that subsidy level down to people who are right at the poverty level, you could have more of an incentive for them to get coverage, but it will depend on how much they actually have to contribute. But if you don't have that mandate,
there's no incentive.
It may not work.
Would you say this is a stealth reduction, massive reduction in Medicaid more than anything else?
Exactly. I mean, that is one of the biggest things about this bill that really hasn't been noticed as much. People have focused on the subsidies to buy coverage or the cost sharing subsidies, that kind of thing. But the idea that you're changing the fundamental nature of the Medicaid program from an open-ended entitlement to one that now is going to have a cap on it is something that could really put a lot of pressure on states. And what people don't understand is the reach of Medicaid. It's one in five Americans. It's half of all births.
Right.
It's two-thirds of covering in nursing homes. It's pretty big.
The untouchable entitlement era may be over. Mary Agnes Carey, partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Fifty years ago, our government drove the innovation that inspired the world and put Americans on the moon.
On Monday, President Donald Trump reminded us of the moon landing and met with 18 heads of U.S. technology companies, his American Technology Council. Did you look carefully, though? Is he in charge of them, or are they in charge of him?
Today, many of our agencies rely on painfully outdated technology. And yet we have the greatest people in technology that the world has ever seen right here with us in this room.
It's clear that Trump remembers the moon landing much better than Apple CEO Tim Cook, who was in first grade at the time, or Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, who wasn't even born. CEO of Amazon Jeff Bezos was 3 when Neil Armstrong took his one small step for man. And today Bezos plays with big rockets of his own and buys grocery store giants. He carted off Whole Foods last week for more than $13 billion.
You know, when we met before in December, I encouraged this administration that you could be the innovation administration.
Amazon is a special case to be lecturing the world about the future of the global economy. From selling books by the click 3 administrations ago, it is now the largest internet-based retailer in the world, the 4th most valuable company in the world, and the 8th largest employer in the U.S. Is Amazon's size a problem? Are the corporations of today of a scale where they can challenge our institutions of government? This hour, a look at the crossroads of modern industrial bigness and economic justice. Stacy Mitchell is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of the report Amazon's Stranglehold. James Marcus worked at Amazon for 5 years between 1996 and 2001. He's editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having
Hello.
Me.
Hello.
So what do you think the secret is to Amazon's growth and how it's managed to come about kind of quietly?
Well, I'm not sure how quiet it really is. I mean, I started at Amazon in 1996 at a time when it was only a bookstore, and it was a tiny company. I was, you know, the 55th or 57th employee there. But even before I started the job, while I was being interviewed for the job, it was clear to me that this gospel of expansionism was very important to Jeff Bezos' vision of the company, and that while books was a great sort of entering wedge in the brand new world of online retail, that he intended to sell everything.
That was clear in the mid-90s.
Even while you were interviewing for a job there was this riff you heard that if you wanted to buy a kayak, not an item that was sold by Amazon then. You could eventually buy a kayak there, but you could book your travel to go kayak somewhere, and you could be put in touch with other fellow kayakers. He saw it as a hub to sell every conceivable good and service from the very beginning.
Amazon has become this very sticky force in our lives. It's been very skilled at luring us into its ecosystem and really locking us in. One of the ways that it did that for years and still does is through a kind of loss leading strategy where it will sell an entire category of goods like books at a loss in order to put out competitors in that sector and bring us into its ecosystem.
I mean, if Bezos had this idea that you can sell everything online, what are the unintended consequences of something being that big? Because it's also true that Amazon gets enormous profit from renting the cloud out, if you see it in its annual reports. Its share of jobs is absolutely huge.
We often talk about Amazon as though it's a retailer, but I don't think that's actually how Amazon sees itself. Amazon really wants to control the basic infrastructure of commerce. It wants to own the online platform through which we buy and sell goods. It wants to own the cloud. It now controls a third of all cloud computing capacity in the world. And it's increasingly building out the infrastructure to do shipping and package delivery. The idea that Amazon has in mind is that by controlling this basic infrastructure, it will be kind of the gatekeeper through which all other companies have to go if they want to sell goods online, if they want to use data in the cloud, if they want to ship things to our doorsteps. And the consequence of that is that Amazon now essentially has privatized the market. It would be as if Walmart came into your community and not only had a giant store there that sold a lot of goods, but also bought up all of the real estate and then became the gatekeeper and determined which other businesses get to have a good spot on Main Street, who gets to sell there under what terms. And that's really what's happened with Amazon's platform. They're now capturing one out of every $2 that Americans spend online. And if you're a producer of goods, a manufacturer of any size, if you're a competing retailer, you now face this really Faustian choice. Do you continue to hang your shingle out on a road that's not very well traveled, that is search engines, or do you give in and become a seller on Amazon's platform? And more companies are finding that that's the only way they can reach customers. But it's very perilous because your Amazon manipulates those markets and uses its power as a gatekeeper to undermine its competitors.
Let's take a look at American history. In industrial growth in the past, there have been certain triggers that caused governments to intervene. And we have this whole antitrust law that has built up around that. It seemed to me that the kinds of things that an auto producer would do around the 1920s that would get the government very, very worried is buy up a steel company. So if the auto company also owned the steel company, that was really concerning to the government, and we created laws to stop that. But Amazon buys Whole Foods, and everyone kind of goes, oh, that's really clever. That's so clever. But what if they bought FedEx tomorrow?
Which they might. I mean, the thing is that there, as you point out, there was an era when that sort of vertical integration was seen as a trigger for antitrust investigation. But there was a big sea change in antitrust policy and enforcement during the Reagan era. Prior to that, a lot of the focus of antitrust had been on breaking up monopolies. But during the Reagan era, the emphasis shifted over to the consumer. And protecting the consumer meant primarily delivering low prices. And so that attitude has been very much to Amazon's advantage, and it has, I think, kept us from being as anxious as we should be about its centralization of so many different parts of the economy.
If your brand identity is benign, Stacey, does that conceal all evil and that whatever the government says, if people love you, then you could do whatever you want with them? You know, freedom kind of goes out the window.
I think we're foolish if we imagine that this kind of centralization of power is going to serve anyone's interests in the long run but Amazon's. You know, our anti-monopoly policies for many decades were broad in the sense that they were concerned not only about our welfare as consumers, but also about the potential of a powerful company overwhelming government, also concerned about our welfare as workers and producers, as small business people. Antitrust used to be as much about liberty as anything else in this sense that you ought to be able to have a fair market where you could go out and ply your trade and be able to compete on a fair playing field. And Amazon has really it has used this shift in antitrust law that is focused so heavily on consumers to its advantage to come in and consolidate and control much of the commerce that is online now and now increasingly moving into the physical world. And we have been very flat-footed in recognizing what's at stake because of those changes that were made in under Ronald Reagan to the antitrust policies.
But 5 years ago, everyone was saying Walmart is the big evil. Walmart is the big evil. Now Amazon is taking on Walmart. Well, hey, great. So you lefties who were mad at Walmart, you know, now you got somebody that's going after Walmart. Now you got to be happy.
But I don't think it's a lefty objection. I think it's wanting to maintain a sort of healthy economic ecosystem in many parts of the economy. I think, to me, it is inherently dangerous to centralize too much in one player. We may get a lower price on Garden Hose or Raisin Bran, but I think we forfeit something important by letting one player dominate so much.
Stacey?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about this, you know, even from our own self-interest. You know, Amazon is destroying the ecology of industries. When we wrote this report that we produced last fall, we interviewed a wide range of manufacturers, and what they all told us is that the prospect of having this one company that is a gatekeeper, where it's very difficult to introduce a new product. You know, Amazon is great for search, but it's not great for discovery. And what these companies all talked about was that the independent brick and mortar stores, the sort of diversity of the marketplace was so critical for a new author or a newly developed toy or a new product to be able to get out there in the marketplace and find an audience. And they're sort of terrified of this prospect of that ecology being destroyed. As consumers, that's going to mean less diversity in the marketplace. And we should be also be mindful that Amazon is not only using its power and all of the data that it collects to manipulate competition, but it's also manipulating us as consumers. Amazon, you know, we've been sort of lulled into the ease and convenience of this to the point that now a majority of people, when they want to buy something online, they don't start at a search engine. They just start at Amazon's website right off.
I mean, that leads to the really key question is bigness in terms of Amazon, bigness in terms of Facebook, bigness in terms of Google. What do you think the ecosystem is with Facebook, Amazon, and Google? Is it competitory? Do they hate each other? Do they love each other? Is one the Ministry of Information? Is the other the Ministry of Raisin Bran?
There's a lot at stake in this consolidation of power and online platforms for the public interest. And I think we really need to step back and take a good look at what's at stake here. You know, we've dealt with these kinds of issues in different ways in the past. You know, a century ago, we dealt with this in railroads. You know, the people who first owned the railroads used that power to discriminate against other companies that wanted to reach the market. There was a lot of cross-ownership. If you owned a mill or a steel company or something, you also bought a railroad, and then you could prevent your competitors from being able to use those lines, or you could charge them higher prices. This is essentially what Amazon is now doing online with its platform. And we developed a body of law that essentially said you are a common carrier, and therefore you have to treat everybody equally. And so when I think about these big platforms and their role, I'm beginning to think we need to look at this idea of public utility regulation. How do we ensure that we get the benefits of some of these innovations, but that we also account for competition and fairness in the market, and that we impose some appropriate rules on how these players operate?
Stacey Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of the report, Amazon Stranglehold. James Marcus is editor of Harper's Magazine, author of Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. Stacey and James, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The United States needs to, in every way, at every level, be working on machine learning and artificial intelligence.
What Chairman Bezos wants, Bezos gets. And if that is investment in artificial intelligence and machine learning, he's got more cash than the government has to push that along for right now. Jeff Bezos also invests billions in brain science. Yet Bezos' own education is conventional. Public elementary school and high school, Princeton grad. He was a science standout, and his parents pushed him into every available science program out there when he was young. Bezos is a model for the STEM worker of the future. But in 2012, the Bureau of Labor Statistics projected that by 2020, there will be 1.4 million computer science-related jobs available and only 400,000 computer science graduates with the skills to apply for those jobs. Christian Mashpia says, we should be confident that with models like Bezos, liberal arts still has a strong future. Christian is the author of Sensemaking, The Power of Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm, and he's noticed a troublesome pattern when it comes to people talking about big data.
I think the beginning where I start getting worried was coming out of Silicon Valley, just like you don't need to study, you don't need to read a book, you just need to learn how to code. That's sort of the first piece of evidence that started worrying me. But then Japan pulled out of all humanities and said, this is not really what we need right now. We don't need people that study history or art history or music. We need engineers. And then came the big campaigns of the, particularly the Republican side of the last election that said, you know, if you want to lead a life where you serve hamburgers for others, then go study, you know, psychology or something like that. Bush Jr. was one of them that said, working in Chick-fil-A is the consequence of studying philosophy. And other people said, we don't need more philosophers in this country. Yet I think we need more.
You actually make the case that there are a lot of very successful people and continue to be a lot of very successful people who come directly from the humanities.
That's the irony, isn't it? That once you get above a certain level in our corporations, you end up among people with PhDs in France, in French or something like that. And that's surprising. So I think there's some sort of a glass ceiling that you can hit if you have no rounded cultural side to you. That's one side. The other side is we started looking at the numbers and we found that if you look at general coming out of college as, a philosophy major or a computer science major, then the general view is that people with a computer science major get a job faster and so on, which is certainly the case. But if you look at the top 5% earners in America, there are three times as many humanities majors as computer science majors. And that's not surprising if you think about it from a general standpoint, but it is not what we talk about in this country. We talk about that the direct way to big salaries and job security is learning how to code.
What is the purpose of a liberal arts education? What in a society does it represent, and why would losing it be a bad thing?
It is the ability to think critically about what's going on around you. It is having a stance of, I wonder if that's true before you just absorb it. I think that's the core of any liberal arts education and having the tools and the reference points in order to do that. And then the second thing is I think the ability to put yourself in other people's shoes. So if you study art and you study the 1920s French art, you have to understand what was that like at that time? What was it like to be Pablo Picasso at that time? And how do you understand what was beautiful and not beautiful and not relevant to him? Or if you want to study Chinese history in the 18th century, you need to somehow put yourself into their world. And I think that's at the heart of any humanities, any liberal arts background is that ability. And it's the same ability you need when you want to understand investors, when you want to understand consumers in Indonesia that buy their first car. So I'm not just saying this for the benefit of beauty. I'm saying it for the benefit of competitiveness.
So logic, critical thinking, empathy, and also a sense of common global knowledge is part of what civilization is, that shared knowledge of liberal arts, liberal education, liberal art history, et cetera.
Right. So what big data doesn't have, or what most data, economic data doesn't have, is context. It's understanding in which context do I put this piece of data, this piece of evidence. And that's something you learn from the humanities or the liberal arts, is the ability to put things into context.
In terms of the merging of STEM, I mean, part of the problem of this whole discussion is that there's some kind of zero-sum game that's played here. You're either a coder or you're a Chinese literature major. In fact, isn't there a convergence of Java coding and understanding world literature and world languages? I mean, can't they all go together?
I hope so. I mean, that's the whole point here, that I think there's been an onslaught on humanities in the past 20 years, and I think it's time that the pendulum swung a tiny bit to the other end. That doesn't mean I'm not into people that build things. I absolutely adore many of the of the effects of STEM. So I'm not saying people shouldn't study STEM or that STEM isn't a worthy sort of object of study or thing to do with your life. What I'm saying is we need both. We need people that can develop medicine, and we need people that can figure out how to get people to take their medicine. We need to people that can...
That's interesting. I like that.
People that can come up with new technology that deal with our CO2 emissions, and we need to have people that can understand the behavior that lead to CO2 emissions.
So, Christian, I suppose the last thing you're going to tell me is you went to engineering school.
Right.
Did
no,
you?
No, I did not. I studied obscure German philosophy.
How's that working out for you?
Well, I'm all right. I think I'm still struggling with many of the texts, but
yes.
But I think, as you know, as a training in my case in philosophy is a way to think, and that can be applied to many areas. And I think what's on the humanities now is to show how do you apply these things to the rest of the world. And I think that's really on the institutions out there that claim themselves to be humanities or liberal arts. You know, how do you use it? Otherwise, you just educate people for no reason other than just their self-indulgence.
Christian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Christian Mashpia is the author of Sense Making, The Power of Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. To hear more from our reporting project examining the future of American higher education, please visit thetakeaway.org/credentials. Earlier this hour, we spoke about how power and authority of an online business like Amazon can be lost when institutions lose the trust of a community they serve. These are life and death issues, though, for law enforcement in American cities, struggling to combat the feeling among African Americans that police are motivated by race when they encounter citizens on the street, that black lives don't matter. Yesterday, we got news of another police acquittal in a police shooting, this time from Milwaukee. The August shooting killed 23-year-old Seville K. Smith. And the police officer behind the trigger now goes free. With this verdict, the Black Lives Matter message once again surfaces as the latest tool to change the racial discourse in America. Changing thought as well as actions is the dual-stroke engine of social change, and Black Lives Matter takes its place next to phrases like Black Power and We Shall Overcome, which in the mid-1960s evoked the struggle for racial justice. Christopher LeBron is an assistant professor of African American Studies and Philosophy at Yale University and is the author of The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea. It's a book he hopes will give a systematic grounding to a generation fluid in digital communications to see how protest born online has the potential to accelerate the mission of activists who came long before them.
I felt we weren't paying enough attention to these historical resonances, and the movement, I think, is trying very powerfully to get people to see that it doesn't make a difference if you didn't pull a trigger. It doesn't make a difference if you didn't sign off on that loan for a black home buyer. It doesn't make a difference, right? Any number other of offenses along those lines. What does make a difference is that you perceive that even if you didn't do any of those things, your ability to live comfortably in America depends on other people living uncomfortably, and you have to do something about that.
Why do you think white privilege is hard to identify and talk about for whites in America?
I think the majority of white Americans genuinely are well-meaning, good-intentioned people who don't endorse racism. But I think by the same token, they're not willing to live uncomfortably for the amount of time it would take for America to readjust to a society that is fully equal. That means putting their kids in schools that they view from their perspective are not as good because they're in underserved black neighborhoods, living closer to people who are lower income or share just a way of life that they simply do not recognize. And so they would like to see a world that there is no racism, but many people simply aren't willing to live uncomfortably. They're not willing to work for it. I think the second reason is that it's difficult because to acknowledge white privilege is to also acknowledge your complicity with a smaller subset of people who are explicitly out to harm and suppress black Americans. That is a remarkably uncomfortable feeling. Those people don't want to be associated with them, but by the same token, because they're not willing to do the hard work, they are complicit and they don't want to face up to that. And that's a very difficult thing to do, which is why the role of love for somebody like James Baldwin was so important.
I'm reminded of the AIDS movement, silence equals death, Complacency is an act.
That's
do
right.
you see a comparison there?
I do see a comparison, and I think the thing that makes it very difficult in the case of racial inequality is that for many people, we're a nation that thinks the rule of law settles all wrongs. And so long as on the books there are laws for equal rights, many people think, well, that's it. My job is done. There is a law, and if the law is broken, surely someone will respond. Hence, you get silence. But what people don't understand is that in a democratic society, when the laws fail, as they routinely do, there must be an accounting of our representatives, of our institutions. Your silence is complicity, and that is an action.
You know, we have gone to places that are associated with a white American economic experience that is both angry and conservative and may various degrees be responsible for the election of Donald Trump. And in our case, we went to Oklahoma, and I could recall very distinctly in this very nice setting, in this wonderful living room of this particularly lovely farm family in Oklahoma, asking this gentleman a question. Can you see, when you hear words like Black Lives Matter, that African-Americans see echoes of what went on during the Jim Crow period and the lynchings and even going back to slavery, that inequality has consequences historically and that those need to be reckoned with today? And he paused for a moment and he looked at me and he said, yeah, but there comes a point where you have to get over that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to people who say that from the comfort of their couches?
The first thing is I would say you're responding to it from the comfort of your couch, by which I mean to say. So let's take the example you just used. It is absolutely true that over the course of American history, it hasn't only been Black Americans who have suffered oppression or marginalization. But the big difference is that at some point, those ethnicities and nationalities that had been persecuted or marginalized, they ultimately received the acknowledgement and the designation of being a white American. And that designation, white American, itself came to be filled with a great deal of value, prestige, power, entitlement. And once that happens, then you have the luxury to forget. You've earned the privilege to forget, to leave history behind. But for everyone else in America who has not earned an equal status, for those of us who don't have the status of equality, of acceptance, right, of the embrace, of the democratic embrace. Well, the forgetting of history is a very dangerous kind of thing. And the kind of thing we've been trying to tell Americans who have this idea, well, we should get over it, is I would love to get over it. The fact of the matter is I can't, because while you historically may have been persecuted today, you could walk the streets without fear of simply walking. While someone like myself, someone like Trayvon Martin, we're not even there yet. So the ability to forget history and leave it behind is something that only comes with a certain kind of safety and comfort on one's couch. And people have to recognize that while it would be fantastic to be able to get over some of these stories, and trust me, all of us would, the fact of the matter is to do so is in some sense to vacate your responsibility as a citizen who lives under a certain kind of disadvantage and who must fight for the same kind of liberties everyone else has been enjoying. And unfortunately, history hasn't left us alone, even though we would love to leave it alone.
Christopher LeBron, thank you so much for being on this program.
Thank you so much for having me on, John. I appreciate it.
Christopher LeBron is the author of The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea.
Broken shards of every heart at some time.
We've talked about all-powerful Amazon this hour, the tenuous hold on civic or urban tension when a police shooting disrupts the community and the power sources are unclear. At certain moments in time, the message of defiance of authority, of being fed up with authority, can best be carried by artists. The Underside of Power is the new album from the band Algiers. Comes out tomorrow. Two members of the band told us how the album was born as Brexit happened. and finished after the U.S. election. Nothing really interesting going on there. Matt Tong, the Algiers drummer, comes to the group from his old band Block Party after Algiers' first record. Franklin Fisher Thomas is the lead singer. He also writes a lot of the songs. Franklin says the band's name is a direct reference to the history of the city of Algiers, with a legacy of French domination, colonization, war, and North African pride.
It's always been very ensconced in the idea of resistance and very aggressively resisting things like hegemony and cultural imperialism and you know, imperialism of ideas and identity as well. Individual stripped away is made the same on the other side.
Matt, what was the transition from musician idea, you know, personal sort of development as a musician and entering the space of various bands?
On paper, this could have been quite an intimidating enterprise to become involved with because Frank, Lee and Ryan have known each other for a very long time. They're very close. They all went to college together. And I joined after the first record was finished and it didn't seem like I had to really think too much about my role in the band, which was actually quite pleasant for me. Like it just felt like all I had to do was show up and like do my best to serve the songs.
I like the combination of soundscape and intense rhythm, and the fact that you're really alive and it's working. I mean, does Radiohead interest you, or do you feel as though they're kind of like over the hump, sort of overplayed?
No, that's my favorite band, but I'm not really allowed to talk about them within the band because I'm a bit too obsessed.
What do you think their impact was?
I think Radiohead are so good at balancing. Just generally balancing things, but in terms of poetics and instrumentation and concept and theme and lyrics, and they've always been quite political, but it's always very understated on record anyway.
Why isn't he allowed to talk about Radiohead?
Hey,
it seems perfectly fine to me.
I'm not injecting myself into this conversation. It's this like predated my involvement with the band. I think it's, you know, sometimes when you're on the road and you're stuck in the van for, you know, up to 10 hours a day, you start developing these in-jokes and recurrent themes kind of, come back into play. And I think Radiohead and Frank's devotion to them is one of those. And, we make fun of him for that. But, like, you know, there's plenty of stuff the rest of the band laugh at me about. And
I gather Cleveland has nothing to do with LeBron James.
No.
The song.
Nah.
Talk to me about that.
I mean, LeBron's cool, but I'm not a fan, really. Cleveland is meant to invoke Tamir Rice and the systematic institutional murder of black people, something that's been going on since before this country was founded and is still going on now. It came about in a way that wasn't necessarily premeditated. Like I wasn't trying to particularly jump on the bandwagon, so to speak, because Black Lives Matter has picked up a lot of steam.
But it does seem that you are referencing a sense of national unrest, but also this idea of the vulnerability of the black body in the song.
Well, yeah, there's definitely that. And moreover, it's the idea of injustice, which is a concept that I'm a bit obsessed with. I was looking at these cases online, and several of them, it's just blatantly crooked. I mean, Trump is crooked and with impunity, and his contingency just let it happen. So, you know.
Although, do you see a tension between what's going on in Washington and the extent to which there's a more open discussion about race and brutality and police cover-ups in cities around the United States, which in some ways is at odds with whatever Trump wants to do?
I think only if that dialogue is forced. And the only way that change has ever been brought about in this country is when America has to face its own hypocrisy, and it can't continue to sell the lie of itself to its people and to the rest of the world if it is forced to look at itself and all of its lies and all the hypocrisy that it's embedded in. I mean, on this record alone, we've got just, you know, the idea of persisting in the wake of certain defeat or certain death, but knowing that you have to do what's right. And that's the main impetus behind your actions.
We've been talking about this recently, haven't we? The kind of conflict between the tendency to want to find something to celebrate versus also being deeply concerned with, you know, the current state of affairs as well. That you know, and I think that's something that maybe comes across a bit more in this record.
Matt, Frankie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Matt Tong and Franklin James Fisher are two members of the band Algiers. Their new album, The Underside of Power, comes out tomorrow on Matador Records. Well, that was a feast of an hour. Lots to talk about. You're talking about the news that Amazon's going to buy Whole Foods for more than $13 billion. Are we going to see more and more of these kinds of mergers and acquisitions? What's the reaction? Austin, Texas, hopefully more competition. Until then, I think higher prices.
This is Annie from Marble Hill, New York. What we stand to lose with all these huge corporations consolidating is we won't be treated like human beings anymore. We'll just be treated like numbers in the shareholders' bottom line.
This is Mark Dressler from San Juan Capistrano, California. You know, what we lose is a sense of cultural intimacy, leaving us with a feeling of disconnectedness, loneliness, and a dark landscape of corporate dominance.
Tell us your fears and thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway, not a division of Amazon.com.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. By Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. LegalZoom.com, providing legal answers to the day-to-day questions of small business owners through its network of independent attorneys, available nationwide. More information at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.